Hello, my name is Luke Clancy, and this is the no longer completely new, but still totally a good idea, Culture File Weekly. It's the downloadable long-form sister of the daily Culture File reports on RTE Lyric FM's Classic Drive programme. Coming up, you'll find some of the best of the past week's files, with some extras to boot. This week, we'll be spending time in a vacant lot off Thomas Street that's been turned into an art project come Curly Kale Jungle, and we'll meet playwright and director Philip McMahon and his mam for a cup of tea and to talk about Donal O'Kelly's play Catalpa. And we'll hear what happens when Alex Petku Colin puts mallet to wood. In every secret garden, a compost heap. Anyone who passed the gallery in the National College of Art and Design on Thomas Street in Dublin in recent weeks may have noticed that behind the big glass window, a garden had bloomed. But the plants in the exhibition Growing Closer by Fabian Strunden and Rian Coulter were really only cuttings, because a few doors down in a disused plot is the real garden, where Strunden and Coulter have been growing huge crops of salads and potatoes and kale, lots of kale. It's easy, as the artists explained to me. All you need is a two-story high compost heap.
I'm Fabian Strunden. I study industrial design in NCAD. And
I'm Rian Coulter, and I study fine print. On Thomas Street, in the centre of the Liberties, we've installed a garden project that we've been working on for the last 2 years. What, to our mind, is the largest greenfield site or brownfield site in Dublin city centre that's been used for the cultivation of organic fruit and vegetables. We're number 100 Thomas Street, and the garden that we have is number 113 that leads from the top of Thomas Street to the back end of Oliver Bond Street.
Used to be an old car park, and now it's used for planting loads of vegetables and stuff.
It is the start of January, so you do have to be somewhat conscious of growing seasons and at what time of the year things, particular things grow. But if you were to go to our garden, there is still salads available pretty much 12 months throughout of the year, whether you use a polytunnel or they're out al fresco.
So maybe we'll go and have a look at the garden then.
It's also quite interesting that Thomas Street would have been a real hub of activity for particularly butchers who would have had their own slaughterhouses here on the street up until very recently, in the last 10, 20 years. And that a lot of the older people on the street are quite taken with the reintroduction of food on the street as well, which is nostalgic but also kind of optimistic as well at the same time too.
It looks like a terraced building rather than a garden.
Well, it's a very unusual route for access. Usually we go through the back.
So this is how we found the garden initially. Fabian running a workshop in here, just by natural curiosity, they went out the back.
It's quite well hidden behind that giant painting, actually. This is definitely a secret garden.
The back door.
Oh yeah, that's the cam collection.
So when Tony originally started working in St Auden's Primary School around the corner and funded a lot of it through the large-scale, almost industrial collection of aluminium cans, so we've started also to collect cans from the street and from the college as well to have them recycled and hopefully turned into funding for such a project.
We were involved both in the Students' Union of NCAD. In my time, I ran workshops in there and was very interested. We had one big project called Art Design and kind of known people from Granary Park and Upstart were involved to run projects alongside this Art Design Week. And we were trying to kind of promote activity in a green space. And Rean then got on to Tony Louth, which is part of the Community Growers, who was very interested in running a project, a bigger garden.
Where does your own horticultural knowledge come from, Rean?
Well, I would be an ecologist and would be very interested in nature and the ecology of plants and wildlife and nature and how we are so dependent on all those things. But when it comes to the manual labour and the organizing of it all. I think that's something that we're both very much interested in facilitating and also being involved in whatever which way we can in terms of working on a site or bringing, you know, aesthetics to such a project. It's quite accessible to anybody who has an interest, because it's quite a common denominator for most people that they are interested in, whether it be the therapeutic or aesthetic element to ecology, gardening, farming, outdoors, nature, particularly seeing as that we're in right smack in the middle of Dublin city centre, to have that kind of utopian outlet in what is kind of a concrete jungle here. I was really interested in, you know, the art and design potential of ecology, nature, and the social aspect as well of people engaging with each other in that kind of an environment. So when Tony, the principal gardener, I suppose the driving force behind this project, began to actually put the literally the earth and seeds together, it became a resource for both the college and students and people in the Liberties to...
The entire garden is built in with a no-dig method. It allows you to grow on top of the soil. So rather than digging into it, you use those beds and you're able to grow on top of the soil.
We make that soil here with a composite of manure for Vicar Street, from the horses, from coffee grinds, from Luncheonette Canteen and all the other cafes and restaurants in the area, and then leaves and other kind of food waste as well to make tradition, and sand and seaweed and things like that, which make a quite a traditional organic compost, which is so rich and fertile for growing the intense growing of potatoes or salads or kale or whatever it might be.
So where's the compost heap?
That's the main spectacle when you walk into the garden. That site is about an acre.
I thought I was getting a whiff, actually.
About an acre and a half we've cultivated so far, so there's ample room on that site to produce, and let's set for however 3 to 12 months to let that mature and to for use in the garden.
And also you can always find one or the other ingredient from the canteen actually originating from this garden, so a lot of the kale would have been used. And that is a nice addition as well, to be able to eat in the college canteen something that is actually grown on the grounds of the college. Quite an unusual setting, I suppose.
The NCAD garden is far from the first city gardener's art project to pop up in Ireland in recent times, but it is perhaps the most ambitious, a pilot for an organic growing centre for the city, as Tony Louth, the gardener, horticultural activist and self-styled guerrilla composter who lent his know-how to the project, explained as we sat in the NCAD gallery last week.
My name is Tony Louth. I'm from Ballybock. I built the community garden in Bridgefoot Street, and I manage the garden, the community garden in St. Auden's School.
So when you first arrived here in 2013, what did you see?
Oh, a vision. I immediately knew how it was going to turn out. I saw this big tract of land, and half an unusable, but good for a nature reserve. And I saw another half, like they had lots of buddleia and in it, okay, I mean, but it was fairly level, okay? So I said to myself, this is ideal. This is the answer to a quest that I've been after for a number of years, because I'm interested in a particular type of gardening. I'm interested in no-dig gardening, because I would consider myself a guerrilla composter. And I would be old enough to remember the Dutch farmers in round Lusk and Skerries, where the vegetables as well as flowers were grown, and them coming into town with their horse and cart and a pyramid of cabbages and going home loaded with manure. I grew up in Richmond Road, and my father was a very good gardener, and we grew vegetables virtually for a family of 12, mother and father and the 10 children. So we were always working in the garden, bringing in the manure, bringing in, collecting leaves, getting seaweed, going down to Dollymount to collect driftwood or clinkers for the fire. So everybody contributed, and we just accepted it as normal. But to me, afterwards, I realized it was a kind of apprenticeship. So when I became a lone parent in 1984, I was able to tap into that. Immediately, I was able to do lots of things. I was just able to get the bicycle out, you know what I mean, start growing plants and things like that. And it was kind of just natural. It just came back to me natural. When I did the community garden in Bridgefoot Street, it was quite large, and people were kind of sort of saying, oh, you're starting a business. And I said, well, you know, I'm not really. And when the potatoes were ready, I just called to the people in the flats and I said, do you want potatoes? I said, bring down a plastic bag, bring a plastic bag, and you can have potatoes. You can go from here to Killarney and not see a vegetable being grown. I mean, that's dreadful. We should be able to overproduce and supply. We should export vegetables. This is what I don't understand. We just have this aversion. Nobody seems to want to challenge it, okay, and to say, well, you know, we it's a marvelous success story with beef, okay, and milk and all this production, okay. But horticulture just seems to be the poor man at the table. We're trying now to make this garden self-sufficient.
You've got a huge compost heap out here now.
Yes, and the seaweed comes from Dollymount. The leaves, some of the leaves from Griffith Avenue, Leeson Street, Leeson Park, the church, and we collect coffee grounds from Nota, and we collected coffee grounds from the Mannings, and we collect coffee grounds from the Luncheonette, and we I believe that they're all free resources, and we just don't use them anymore.
My name is Jenny Moran and I run Luncheonette, which is an art project / canteen which operates in the basement of the National College of Art and Design on Thomas Street. It's for students and people passing by.
So what kind of things in the garden have inspired things that you've served here?
Well, something that's been consistently abundant in the garden is kale. So we use that every week for this soup called Ribollita, which is this kind of Tuscan everything soup with, I think there has to be some kind of cabbage. So it would be maybe cavolo nero or something like that. But we have this gorgeous kale so nearby. So it's kind of everything, whatever's at hand. But the consistent thing is some form of cabbage. So we put white beans in it as well so that it would be more substantial, it's like a meal. And there's torn up bread and parmesan. And then Wagner, who works here, makes a lovely walnut pesto. So it's kind of like a meal.
What the lads were saying to me was that they didn't actually know much about the detail of how you might run a garden. So what did you say to them that they needed to grow? Or how did you work out what should go in that garden? Because it seems like you gave the instruction on that.
The first thing I put in was potatoes, because they make a beautiful showing. And they really can impress people by the flowers. There's banks of flowers when they, and the early potatoes particularly would be ready within 13 weeks. So you have a kind of an early start on them, and then we graduated from there. That I asked somebody, would we help grow seedlings? So they grew the seedlings, and so I just took them and we started planting. So it was kind of it just developed kind of naturally, mishmash, okay, in the beginning. And then some groups came up and we decided we'd plant up boxes. And Wagner, the chef from the Luncheonette here, came over and he started planting salads and carrots. And so I sort of said, well, feel free, just go buy a few seeds, go down, look at the seed packets, okay? If you like the seed packet, just bring it up here and we'll plant it. The problem with growing in the derelict sites is that no compost is made. There is no community composting. So when you import the soil, it just doesn't work. You'll notice, if you noticed in the garden, there are virtually no weeds. There's also there are no slugs. Now, they were the bane of every gardener's life. But in the no-dig method, done properly, and with a little bit of intelligence, okay, you save yourself all those bothers. And the other thing is, it doesn't need watering because you're using organic matter. And when you bring a ton of seaweed onto the land, you're bringing 3/4 of a ton of water. So if you've put it into the soil, okay, compost, it works. It's beautiful. This is a pilot, kind of a pilot for an organic center. And then we're going to do follow no dig, and then we're going to start producing salads. I want to use this place to, if for as long as I am allowed, okay? So I if the boss man here says go, I have to go, and I absolutely know that. But so far, I've been told that there's no real plans for the place. So I just accept it, and I just go on. And if we don't do it here, you know, the works will still carry on, because people have seen, people will learn. Everybody can help. Everybody can grow. People are benefiting, okay? And as long as people are benefiting, just keep on that road.
Tony Lowe there on the enduring attractions of a well-maintained compost heap. And there's no link whatsoever between the last item and the next one. None at all. So let's just switch everything off and back on again before we move on. Ah, that's better. Now, Alex Petku-Cullen is a Cork-born percussionist who's recently become the National Concert Hall's Rising Star of 2015. He showed me around his Crumlin House come marimba storage facility and the contents of his white van.
So here we are in the driveway in the freezing cold, about to snow.
It is about to snow, isn't it?
Yeah.
How's that feeling?
Now we have some timpani in here. And we have a few cases and things.
They look kind of alien in there.
Yeah, just the way they are, just the way they're stored.
This is gives a lie to the cliche, you know, white van man. You might open the door of the white van and find inside it some timpani or a marimba. Yeah.
Didn't expect that, did you? This is part of the job, I suppose. One way, keep fitting by playing. The other one, by lifting instruments.
We're going to go through to the other room now where you have your instrument set up. What are we going to hear?
Yeah, so I'm going to play, it's a piece by Evan Glennie, who's probably the first full-time solo percussionist. And she's probably a big influence for my concert in terms of style of playing and all of that. So the piece is called A Little Prayer, and it's a marimba piece.
That she wrote?
Yeah, she wrote when she was 13.
It's nearly 20 years now since Donal O'Kelly first set sail aboard the good ship Catalpa, telling the story of a whaling ship which rescued six Irish prisoners from an Australian penal colony in 1876 in his epic one-man show, Catalpa, now almost as legendary as the ship itself. This spring, O'Kelly has set off once more touring Ireland with his unsinkable show, and for the occasion we press-ganged playwright and director Philip McMahon and his mam, Angela, to assess the Catalpa's latest tour over a pot of tea in the kitchen of Mrs. McMahon's home in Finglas.
Hello?
Should I have a cup of tea or coffee?
Speaking of weather conditions, New York's snowed over.
We've got our bloody, bad, isn't it?
Yeah, we've got our 24-hour plays. People have got to come from New York on Thursday.
Oh, I don't need to get out, Phil.
We got talking to some other people in the audience, didn't we?
Yeah.
What was interesting was that it was kind of, there was this legend or there was this cult around the show where many people in the audience had seen it before. And some people spoke about when they had seen it, how long, because the show was essentially on the road. The show is like Riverdance. It's on the road for 20 years.
Yeah.
And
one girl follows Donal O'Kelly.
That's right, yeah.
Wherever he is, she goes to Kilkenny, Galway when he was there, and somewhere else she mentioned.
And she was there with her son. She'd brought him to Catalpa for the first time when he was 14.
Yeah.
And so he was 34 there last night. There was a lot of sons with mothers in the audience last night.
Yeah.
I don't know what that says about the show. That's usually the kind of audience that Panty gets. But but also Catalpa was getting that as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of felt like a family show in a way. I don't know. Like there was actually a couple of kids there, but like in the sense of there was
teenagers, kind of, yeah.
Intergenerational, yeah. Which was really nice, and people seem to have a massive fondness for the show
for Donal O'Kelly himself,
his work, and I suppose the ethos around his work as well.
Mm.
So the story is about the ship, Catalpa, and it's about the captain's name is
George Anthony.
George Anthony, who is commissioned or commandeered to rescue six Fenian prisoners from Fremantle, Australia, and he is in he's in upstate New York or something like that.
Yeah,
isn't he?
Yeah,
yeah. And so we follow the journey of the Catalpa, a whaling ship, across the oceans to rescue these prisoners.
And John Devay was the leader of the Clan na Gael. He ordered them to go and bring them back, and he was supposed to be one of the worst feared Fenians in the Republic at the time.
Have you been on Google this morning?
No, I was reading it on Google last night.
Stow the anchor chains! Dunker, dunker, roller, roller, chink, chink! Dunker, dunker, roller, roller, chink, chink! Busy, busy!
I think that's the fear, isn't it, with one people show it. You kind of go, when they start talking, because it takes you 5 minutes to get into the rhythm of how somebody's going to talk or the language that they're using, and you think, oh God, is this for me? Am I going to understand it? You know?
Yeah, I thought that straight away. It took me about 15 minutes and I'm saying, I'm not going to understand this. But as it was going on, I did, you know, and Donal he was like a bird flapping his wing, and he was flying and he was landing and he was making all the sounds, and different birds, different sounds. And these were the birds that was on the ship that I'd land on.
Kind of used that, didn't you, to punctuate?
You
started getting into story via the birds and the seagulls.
And then he'd leave that and he'd go back to the birds. Cuckoo, cuckoo, cuckoo.
Okay.
Very good. I was seasick half the time listening to him, you know, about the water. And I said there was only one prop on the stage, which was a curtain, and he used that all the way through. He used it as his mother-in-law put it over his head, and he imitated his mother-in-law. He used it for the birds flapping their wings, for the waves in the sea as the ship was going up and down. And like, you have curtains here up on, you just put them up on the windows, but he used it for everything. He had it around him when he was cold. He had it as a flag. He had it as say, the birds, the waves flapping. His mother-in-law's mantilla, his daughter's or his wife's, as she was telling him not to go to sea anymore, he used that imitating her voice. Yeah. When the mother-in-law was saying, "You promise me you will not go to sea again. You will never cross these rivers anymore."
Max, shush.
Whaley, whaley. He made up a song about it as he was going along, you know, and he was singing it halfway through, and then he'd stop and he'd start again. I can't even think of it. What was it? Whaley, whaley. You know, come on.
No, I don't know. I can't remember. We spent the whole interval singing it last night.
But goes home and he says, "Greta, I'm home." And he says, "Hello, Pearl." And Pearl says, "Mummy, I think it's Papa." The end. "I think it's Papa." They got a good ovation, though, didn't they? Like, everyone stood up, and which was brilliant, you know. I think he was kind of had a little tear in his eye, didn't he? He looked as if
I think you're projecting onto.
No, I think he had a little tear in his eye. Yeah. he's so full of life. He's like a 20-year-old the way he moves around the stage, isn't he? It's all about movement with him. You know, an awful lot of movement with him. No, you wouldn't think he was over 20 years old now. And you wouldn't think he was, you know, unless you really looked at his face. Very fair.
Catalpa, in the way it's performed, in the way that it's written, has this timeless quality to it. The framework of the movie thing, you know, I think that with the likes of Stones in His Pockets and stuff like that, we have seen, since then, we have seen other things that have had the same framework. So in a sense, you kind of think, all right, well, that sets it in a period of time or in a palette of other plays or whatever. It's just good, old-fashioned Irish storytelling. And I use old-fashioned in the best possible way, in the sense of, in the classic sense. Catalpa is not a museum piece. Certainly not.
It could go on and on and on. Now, the only thing I could say, they could do without the break and just go through. Because when we came back off the break, it was only about 20 minutes left. So we could have went, well, I know he has to have a break and that, but...
what did we have at halftime?
Smoke. It's too long. I don't go to the cinema even because it's too long watching a film without having a cigarette. So that just suited me fine. Now imagine 11 months on a ship without a cigarette. That's all I was thinking.
Philip McMahon and his mam Angela there on the privations of a night at the theatre. And it's in the McMahon's kitchen that we close another week of Culture Files. But come Monday at 5:40 on RTE Lyric FM, we'll start on a brand new batch. And if you'd like to hear more about those, you could follow us on Twitter. That's @CultureFilePod. Bye now.